tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to part 14 of The International Jew by Henry Ford. I am your host, Ted Midward. The title of this article is The High and Low of Jewish Money Power. We start out with an excerpt at the top of the page from Protocol Number 20. It says, "Economic crises were created by us for the Gentiles only by the withdrawal of money from circulation. The present issue of money does not coincide with the need per capita, and consequently it cannot satisfy all the needs of the working classes. You know that gold currency was detrimental to the governments that accepted it, for it could not satisfy the requirements for money, since we took as much gold as possible out of circulation." That's an excerpt from Protocol Number 20. Jewish high finance first touched the United States through the Rothschilds. It may, indeed, be said that the United States founded the Rothschild fortune, and, as so often occurs in the tale of Jewish riches, the fortune was founded in war. The first $20 million the Rothschilds ever had to speculate with was money paid for Hessian troops to fight against the American colonies. Since that first indirect connection with American affairs, the Rothschilds have often invaded the money affairs of the country, though always by agents. None of the Rothschild sons thought it necessary to establish himself in the United States. Anselm remained in Frankfurt. Solomon chose Vienna. Nathan Mayer went to London. Charles established himself in Naples. And James represented the family in Paris. These were the five warlords of Europe for more than a generation, and their dynasty was continued by their successors. The first Jewish agent of the Rothschilds in the United States was August Belmont, who came to the United States in 1837 and was made chairman of the Democratic National Committee at the outbreak of the Civil War. The Belmonts professed Christianity, and there is today a Belmont Memorial called the Oriental Chapel, in the new Cathedral of St. John the Divine on Morningside Heights. Rothschild power, as it was once known, has been so broadened by the entry of other banking families into governmental finance that it must now be known not by the name of one family of Jews, but by the name of the race. Thus, it is spoken of as international Jewish finance, and its principal figures are described as international Jewish financiers. Much of the veil of secrecy, which contributed so greatly to the Rothschild power, has been stripped away. War finance has been labeled for all time as blood money, and the mysterious magic surrounding large transactions between governments and individuals, by which individual controllers of large wealth were made the real rulers of the people, has been largely stripped away and the plain facts disclosed. The Rothschild method still holds good, however, in that Jewish institutions are affiliated with their racial institutions in all foreign countries. There are Jewish banking firms in New York whose connections with firms in Frankfurt, Hamburg, Dresden, as well as in London and Paris, can be traced by the mere matter of the signs over the doors. They are one. As a leading student of financial affairs puts it, the world of high finance is largely a Jewish world because of the Jewish financiers' absence from national or patriotic illusions. To the international Jewish financier, the ups and downs of war and peace between nations are but the changes of the world's financial market. And, as frequently the movement of stocks is manipulated for purposes of market strategy, so sometimes international relations are affected for mere financial gain. It is known that the recent Great War was postponed several times at the behest of international financiers. If it broke out too soon, it would not involve the states which the international financiers wished to involve. Therefore, the masters of gold, that is, the international masters, were compelled several times to check the martial enthusiasm which their own propaganda had aroused. It is probably quite true, as the Jewish press alleges, that there has been discovered a Rothschild letter dated 1911 and urging the Kaiser against war. The year 1911 was too early. There was no such insistence in 1914. Not only do these foreign financial affiliations cast a different light on purely national matters affecting the peace and prestige of the peoples, but they tend toward an extra or super nationality. When these foreign affiliations enable Jewish bankers to excel in the more highly specialized forms of finance, such as foreign exchange, they also enable them to exercise almost complete control over international money movements. There is no question whatever of international Jewish finance being deeply concerned in the matters of war and revolution. This is never denied as to the past, but it is just as true of the present. The League Against Napoleon, for example, was Jewish. Its headquarters were in Holland. When Napoleon invaded Holland, the headquarters were moved to Frankfurt on the Main. It's remarkable how many of the international Jewish financiers have come out of Frankfurt, the Rothschilds, the Schiffs, the Spires, to name but a few. The racial affiliations running all through the world of international finance are readily recognized. These associations produce, in Jewish banking circles, a constant tendency toward a control or monopoly of certain lines of industry which are identified with the fields of finance. The rule is, once control is gained, all non-Jewish interests must be driven out. Jewish financial interests have rarely been connected with industrials, says the Jewish Encyclopedia, except as regards some of the precious stones and metals, the Rothschilds controlling mercury, Barnato Brothers and Werner and Bate and Company, diamonds, and the firms of Lewison Brothers and Guggenheim Sons controlling copper, and to some extent, silver. To this, of course, may be added whiskey, wireless, theaters, the European press, and part of the American, and a number of other fields. The list will be made complete in this series of articles before they are finished. The Jewish Encyclopedia continues. It is, however, mainly in the direction of foreign loans that there has been any definite predominance of Jewish financiers, this being due, as stated before, to the international relations of larger Jewish firms. In order that the senseless denials of certain portions of the Jewish press may be checked, it may be said that Jewish authorities do not deny such statements as are made about Jewish international financial control, although the declare it is not as strong as it once was. That should read, although they declare. Of more recent years, says the Jewish Encyclopedia, non-Jewish financiers have learned the same cosmopolitan method and, on the whole, the control is now rather less than more in Jewish hands than formerly. This is true, at least so far as the United States is concerned. Previous to the war, the status of many of the Jewish financial concerns in Wall Street was stronger than it is now. The war brought about a condition which threw a new light on the internationalism of Jewish finance. During the years of American neutrality, there was opportunity to observe the extent of the foreign affiliations of certain men, and also the extent to which ordinary national loyalty was subordinated to the business of international finance. The war really forced a coalition of Gentile capital on one side of the struggle, as against certain blocks of Jewish capital which were willing to play both sides. The old Rothschild maxim of, "Do not put your eggs, all of your eggs, in one basket," becomes perfectly plain when transposed into national and international terms. Jewish finance treats political parties the same, bets on them both, and so never loses. In the same way, Jewish finance never loses a war. Being on both sides, it cannot miss the winning side, and its terms of peace are sufficient to cover all advances to the side that lost. This was the significance of the great swarming of Jews at the peace conference. That would be the Versailles Peace Conference. Many of the Jewish houses on Wall Street were originally the American branches of long-established houses in Germany and Austria. These international firms were accustomed to support one another with capital and maintained other intimate associations. Some of them are linked by intermarriage, but the bond above all is the Jewish racial bond. Most of these houses received a severe setback during the war because their overseas associations were not of the right kind. But this setback is expected to be only temporary, and the Jewish financiers will again be ready to give battle for the entire financial control of the United States. Whether they will be successful, the future will decide, but a strange fatality seems to follow all forms of Jewish supremacy. Just as the capstone is ready to be placed upon the edifice of Jewish triumphs, something occurs and the structure shrinks. It occurs so often in Jewish history that the Jews themselves have been exercised to find an explanation. In many cases, anti-Semitism offers a ready excuse, but not always. Just at the present time, when the light which was shed by the fires of war has revealed so many matters formerly hidden in shadow, the awakening of the world attention is called anti-Semitism, and the explanation is given that after every war, the Jew becomes the scapegoat, a curious admission which would lead a less self-centered people to inquire, why? But so handy and so untrustworthy an explanation as anti-Semitism does not account for the failure of Jewish financial interests to become absolutely dominant in the country like the United States. Anti-Semitism among the people does not surge high enough to injure those securely entrenched behind great financial influence. The silent resistance of the Wall Street Financial Group or of the New York Stock Exchange, for example, is not anti-Semitism. It is not a hindrance to the Jews in doing business. It is opposition to an apparent program of total control which is sought not for the general good, but for a racial benefit. It was only a few years ago that the banking house of Kuhn, Loeb & Company was commonly regarded as being destined in the near future to win complete financial supremacy in Wall Street as an underwriting and money-lending institution. There were many reasons for this belief, among them the fact that Kuhn, Loeb & Company were the financial backers of Harriman in his terrific railroad duel with James J. Hill. But the prophecy regarding this financial institution was never realized. Untoward events intervened, in no way affecting the financial integrity of the firm, but bringing it into the light of undesirable publicity, not of a financial character. In the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, Jewish finance in the United States reached its high water mark. The head of this firm was the late Jacob Schiff, who was born in the Frankfurt-on-Main, whose father was one of the Rothschilds' brokers. One of Jacob Schiff's associates, Otto Kahn, was born in Mannheim and was early associated with the Spires, who also originated in the Frankfurt-on-Main. Another associate, Felix Warburg, married into Jacob Schiff's family. Jewish finance has spread, but it has not risen higher than in this firm. A flank movement, however, has been attempted, which may bring Jewish ambitions nearer the goal of their desire. Checked in Wall Street, Jewish financiers have sought out other American centers, and even foreign centers whose influence on American affairs promises to be considerable. The first flank movement is towards Central and South America. It may be said that the financial assistance, practical and advisory, offered to Mexico during the most unsatisfactory period of her relations with the U.S., was given by Jewish financial groups. The attempt to gain influence with Japan seems to have come off rather badly. It is known, of course, that Jacob Schiff gave material assistance to Japan in the war with Russia. This was explainable on the ground of good business and also of a desire to revenge Russia's treatment of the Jews. Mr. Schiff used the opportunity to also instill the principles, which have since grown up into Bolshevism, into the minds of Russian prisoners in Japanese war camps. But more than that, the idea appears to have been to add to the newly rising Japanese power to the string of Jewish financial conquests. Jewish finance already has a foothold in Japan, but it appears that Mr. Schiff's hopes in this respect were not fully realized. The Japanese are credited with knowing much more about the Jewish peril than even the United States does, and they were exceedingly wary. They kept the business deal strictly a business deal, and Mr. Schiff was said to have been displeased with Japan generally. This is well worth knowing at this time, especially in view of the propaganda which seeks constantly to cause misunderstandings to arise between the U.S. and the Empire of Japan. But South America appears to be the latest objective. It must be remembered that the Jews exercise world control in two departments, in movements of men and in movements of money. No government, no church, no school of thought could order the movement of 250,000, half a million, or even a million people from one part of the world to another, shifting them as a general shifts his army. But the Jews can do that. They are doing it now. It's only a matter of ships. From Poland, where Jewish special privileges have been written into the law of the land by the all-powerful peace conference, and where it would seem that the Jews have every reason to remain, there is a great movement westward. It is not a stampede, as the American Commissioner of Immigration says, although it may look so from this side. It is an orderly movement, as can be seen when the American Jewish directors on the other side are observed. And part of it is being directed to South America. It is said that after a period of training in the United States, some of the immigrants who are now landing here will be shipped south again. This other mastery which the Jews exert in a world degree is that over the movement of gold. Without giving expression to what the purpose may be, there is this to be said. A large movement of Jewish men and Jewish gold proceeds towards South America these days. And there is to be said a large movement of other materials, which when interpreted by the protocols, can mean but one thing. The next attempt for control of the Americas may come from the South, where the Jews are already stronger than their numbers would indicate, and where their revolutionary proclivities have already come into play as between the various states. These rebuffs and these strategic flank movements do not, however, complete the record. We are now speaking of American finance only. The Jews have not been restrained elsewhere as they have been in Wall Street. They exercise a very ominous control in a number of other fields, each of which will be taken up in detail in due time. For the present, our attention is being directed to New York and its financial district. We have just shown the high water mark of Jewish control as it has been reached up to this date in the street. There is another aspect of Jewish influence on the financial affairs of America which is not so flattering to that race. If Jewish financial activity does not go higher, it goes lower and finds its way into darker channels than does any other form of financial activity in the country. It would make a sordid tale. The operations of the Robins, the Lamars, the Arnsteins, and the others who have contributed to the long roll of criminality produced within the shadow of Wall Street, and the only point that could be served by its retelling is that such criminality is predominantly Jewish. This is not to say that it has the approval of the Jewish community, but it is very significant that while the whole volumes of abuse have been heaped upon the Dearborn Independent's very modest effort to state that the status of the Jewish question in America, the leaders of Jewry have been silent about the criminal financial operations of those who could be made to feel the displeasure of their race. The Jewish passion for the defense of the race, regardless of the degree of guilt, is well known to every prosecuting attorney, although it must be said that during the investigation made some years ago, which revealed the business of commercialized vice to be under Jewish control, certain public-spirited Jews commendably aided the work. This aid, however, did not prevent the severest opposition to certain publications, which gave notice of the facts that the investigators were finding. This country was lately astounded by the revelation that stocks and liberty bonds to the value of $12 million had been lost through a systematic series of thefts in Wall Street. Beginning with the spring of 1918, messengers sent out by the New York Stock Exchange firms to make deliveries of stocks and bonds to other houses, in the course of ordinary business, began to disappear as if the earth had swallowed them up. For a time, these disappearances were without explanation. Wall Street is a really small district. Most of its business is done within the space of a city block. Messengers, on their trips, sometimes went only to another floor in the same building, or to an office across the street. Yet, in those short trips, they would disappear with all their securities, seldom to be heard of again. Imagine that. Up to the summer of 1918, the absconding messenger boy was a rarity. The type was regarded with good-humored indulgence on the street. They were generally happy-go-lucky youngsters, and the steadier heads among them graduated into clerks in the commission houses. The labor shortage struck Wall Street, along with other sections of the country, and messenger boys were difficult to find. During this period, there was also a great expansion in business. Nearly everyone in the country possessed bonds of some kind, and these changed hands in unparalleled quantities. On the floor of the stock exchange, the daily transaction in bonds, up to $20 million, and in stocks, up to 1 or 2 million shares, were common. Following the sales, the stocks and bonds were transferred from seller to buyer by messenger boy. It was not unusual for irresponsible lads to be running from office to office in Wall Street with $250,000 under each of the arms. Then, with the shortage of boys, another type of messenger began to appear, and with this type, trouble began. Disappearances and losses became more frequent and costly. The indemnities paid by the insurance companies reached such staggering figures that the custom of issuing blanket insurance was withdrawn. Various expedients were adopted to solve the mystery. Boys were required to travel in pairs, guards were posted throughout Wall Street, the best detectives in the land were assigned to the matter, but without avail. There was a strong disinclination in Wall Street towards publishing the figures of the losses, for the fear the publication might be destructive of public confidence in the street's financial condition. But the news was known in the underworld and drew to New York criminals from all parts of the country. For a time, all efforts were fruitless. The losses continued and the mystery deepened. Then, suddenly, in the early part of 1920, certain arrests were made and confessions obtained, which disclosed one of the most amazing criminal conspiracies in the history of the United States. There was proved the existence of a vast Jewish conspiracy to loot Wall Street. It was found that a band of astute Jewish criminals, most of them wealthy men, some of them ex-convicts, had created an organization by which Wall Street financial houses were to be plundered. Bands of young Jews, mostly of Russian origin and living on the East Side, had been shaped into being. These lads, instructed by clever Jewish principals, applied to Wall Street messenger agencies for employment in brokerage houses. It was part of the plan for them to assume good, honest-sounding Anglo-Saxon names. The cover name! How often we meet it. These lads turned over their stolen stocks and bonds to the heads of their organizations, who in turn passed the securities on to the Jewish principals, who were for the most part members of the criminal band of con men, while in the White Light District, rather, the bankroll men, whose immunity from punishment has always been one of the standing puzzles of Gentiles residing in New York. These Jewish criminals were aided by Jewish lawyers in their transactions. The stolen stocks and bonds were taken to Cleveland, Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, parts of Canada, where they were pledged as collateral for loans in an apparently legitimate course of business. One of the messenger boys refused to deliver his stolen securities for the small sum he was offered for them and ran away to enjoy alone his ill-gotten wealth. His hiding place was discovered, and members of a band of Harlem assassins were sent for him, with instructions to find where the securities were. If they were on the boy's person, he was to be killed at once. This band entertained the boy with drinks and women for several days until they learned that the securities were sewed inside the lining of his coat. They took him for a joyride into the country, and his dead body was afterward found, typically slain, with about 24 dagger wounds in his body. In one instance, a non-Jew was inveigled into the nefarious scheme, and the method was also typical. The Jewish principals wished for another clearinghouse through which to dispose of their securities, and were tipped off that a young, non-Jewish broker was on the verge of bankruptcy. He was helped out, and given what appeared to him to be a very profitable piece of business. Once in the power of his friends, and deeply entangled in their game, he tried to get out of it. He was threatened with death. The Jewish principal said to him, "I don't want any double-crossing here, or I'll kill you in a minute. If I can't do it, if I'm locked up, there are plenty of my gang who will do it." Upon the arrest and confession of this non-Jew, many of the Jewish principals fled New York, traveling, as usual, under their assumed Christian names. But their identity had at least become known, and although many of their messenger boy dupes had been made to suffer the penalty for their crimes, the leaders at this writing, yet free, and the most powerful influences seemed to be invoked to protect them from the ordinary operations of the law. A few have been captured, but although their accusers are the most powerful banking, brokerage, and surety companies on Wall Street, a power greater still seems to defend them from the treatment usually accorded known criminals. One of the ringleaders has defied the courts with impunity and still walks the streets. Jewish theatrical managers in New York have headlined his actress wife, a Jewess, presumably because of the added prestige it gave her to be the wife of the world-defying bond thief. That is the element which strikes something like consternation to the heart of the ordinary lover of law and order. The insolence with which these wealthy Jewish criminals regard all the agencies of law. They are defended by clever lawyers, and the attitude of the Jewish press and Jewish population toward them is compact of sympathy and admiration. Why not? Since most of the individual victims of the thievery are Gentiles, and the general victim is Gentile capitalism itself. There is complete silence on the Jewish side regarding this reign of crime, and yet inevitably the Jews themselves must suffer most from it. The New York Kehillah has completely ignored this outbreak and its exposure. The spokesmen of Jewry, so voluble against non-Jews, have no word to say to those whom they would probably call their co-religionists. Yet it is well enough understood that so closely combined are all the influences in New York Jewry that a determined effort on the part of the leaders could clean up many untoward conditions now existing. But there seems to be a distinct aversion to anything that will indicate a division of one class of Jews against another. It is a racial instinct, evidently, to protect the threatened one no matter how richly he may deserve punishment. It is this fact which put the finishing Jewish touch on the whole matter. It may, of course, be an accident that all the criminals and their tools, with an occasional exception, are Jews. That of itself might not be a reason, in the extreme sense, for labeling the condition with a racial name. But the silence, the approbation in some quarters, the very active sympathy in others, all combining as a racial protectorate around the wrongdoers, is the more regrettable manifestation of the two. Okay, let's move on to the second half of our reading here. The next article is entitled, Disraeli of America, a Jew of Superpower. Although the war had the effect of decreasing Jewish power in Wall Street by temporarily hindering, but perhaps not altogether breaking off, the communication between Jewish financial houses in the United States and their associates overseas, it also had the effect of greatly increasing Jewish wealth in this country. It is stated upon the authority of a well-informed Jewish source that, in New York City alone, fully 73% of the war millionaires are Jews. The mistake should not be made of assuming that because of the temporary setback in Wall Street, the war meant a total setback for the Jewish program. It did not. Jewry emerged from the war more strongly entrenched in power, even in the United States, than it was before. And in the world at large, the ascendancy of the Jew, even where he was in control before, is very marked. A Jew is now president of the League of Nations. A Zionist is president of the Council of the League of Nations. A Jew is president of France. A Jew was president of the committee to investigate the responsibility for the war, and one incident of his service was the disappearance of vital documents. In France, Germany, and England, the financial power of the Jews, as well as the filtration of their dangerous ideas of social disorder, have greatly increased. It is a most remarkable fact that, in those countries which can justly be called anti-Semitic, the rule of the Jew is stronger than anywhere else. The more they are opposed, the more they show their power. Germany is today an anti-Semitic nation. Yet, in spite of all the German people have done to get rid of themselves of this visible show of Jewish power, it has entrenched itself more firmly than before, above and beyond the reach of the German popular will. France becomes increasingly anti-Semitic, and as the anti-Jewish wave rises, a Jewish president appears. Russia itself is anti-Semitic to the core, and the Jew is Russia's new tyrant. And at a moment when, as all Jewish spokesmen inform us, there is a world wave of anti-Semitism, which is their name for a new awakening of the nations to what has been going on, what should occur but that at the head of the League of Nations, in a position which, but for the absence of the United States, would constitute the chief magistracy of the world, a Jew appears. Nobody seems to know why. Nobody can explain it. Neither previous fitness nor public demand pointed him out, yet there he is. In our own country, we have just a 4-year term of Jewish rule, almost as absolute as that which exists in Russia. This appears to be a very strong statement, but it is somewhat milder than the facts warrant, and the facts themselves are not of hearsay origin, nor the product of a biased point of view. They are the fruits of an inquiry by the lawful officials of the United States, who were set aside in favor of a ready-made Jewish government, and they are forever spread upon the official records of the United States. The Jews have proved for all time that the control of Wall Street is not necessary to the control of the American people, and the person by whom they proved this was a Wall Street Jew. This man has been called the proconsul of Judah in America. It is said that once, referring to himself, he exclaimed, "Behold, the Disraeli of the United States." To a select committee of the Congress of the United States, he said this, "I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless, that is true." And in saying so, he didn't overstate the case. He did have more power. It was not all legal power, this much he admitted. It reached into every home and store and factory and bank and railway and mine. It touched armies and governments. It touched the recruiting boards. It made and unmade men without a word. It was power without responsibility and without limit. It was such a power as compelled the Gentile population to lay bare every secret before this man and his Jewish associates, giving them a knowledge and an advantage that billions of gold could not buy. Doubtless, not one in every 50,000 of the readers of this paper ever heard of this man before 1917, and doubtless the same number have clear knowledge of him now. He glided out of a certain obscurity, unlighted by public service of fame, into the high rulership of the nation at war. The constituted government had little to do with him save vote the money and do his bidding. He said that men could have appealed over his head to the President of the United States, but, knowing the situation, men never did. Who is this figure, colossal in his way, and most instructive of the readiness of Judah to take the rule whenever he desires? His name is Bernard M. Baruch. He was born in South Carolina 50 years ago, the son of Dr. Simon Baruch, who was a medical man of some consequence. "I went to college with the idea of becoming a doctor, but I did not become a doctor," he told the Congressional Committee. He was graduated at the College of the City of New York when he was just under 19 years of age. This college is one of the favorite educational institutions with the Jews, its president being Dr. S. E. Mezes, a brother-in-law of Colonel E. M. House, the colonel whose influence and disfavor at the White House has for a long time been a favorite subject of wondering speculation on the part of the American people, though it scarcely need be so any longer. Apparently, young Baruch knew exactly what he wanted to do and set out to do it. He says he spent many years after his graduation in certain studies, particularly economics, as related to railroads and industrial propositions. "I tried to make Poor's Manual and the financial supplement of the Financial Chronicle my Bible for a number of years." He could not have spent very many years in these pursuits, for after going down to Wall Street as a clerk and a runner, and when he was about 26 or 27, he became a member of the firm A.A. Houseman & Company. In about 1900 or 1902, he left the firm, but he had meanwhile gained a seat on the stock exchange. He then went into business for himself, a statement that must be taken literally in view of his testimony that he did not do any business for anybody but himself. "I made a study of the corporations engaged in the production and manufacture of different things, and a study of the men engaged in them." In answer to questions intended to disclose the exact nature of his operations before he suddenly appeared as the man who had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war, he stood off from any intimations that he perhaps engaged in mere buying and selling of stock. "My business then became the organization of various enterprises," he said, "and in connection with that I, of course, did buy and sell stocks. If I organized any concern, I naturally took a large interest in it, or I would not organize it if I did not believe in it. And I stayed with the development of that concern, and then, if I cared later on to sell it, I would sell it." Pressed by the examiners for a still more detailed account of his activities in business, he went on to say, "Well, I was instrumental in the purchase of the Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company, in the purchase of Selby Smelter, Tacoma Smelter, and various copper, tungsten, rubber. I was instrumental in building up one of the great industries in rubber in Mexico, which was the establishment of the source of supply of rubber, and developed a large concern there for the production of raw material, which is still going on. I became interested in the new process of concentration of low-grade ores in the Mesaba Range, but the interest I had particularly in steel was in the study of present-day organization, in order to get myself posted so that I could intelligently buy or sell their securities." It is an important point, one not made very clear in the testimony, what interests Mr. Baruch held at the beginning of the war. His previous activities in various fields, principally perhaps in the field of metals, has been important and numerous. In any case, as a young man, he is found to be master of large sums of money, and there is no indication that he inherited it. He is very wealthy. What change the war made in his wealth, if it made any change at all, is a matter on which nothing may be said now. Certainly, many of his friends and closest associates reaped great quantities of money from their activities during the war. Now, as to the point of his business connections just prior to the war, this testimony appears. Mr. Graham says, "You continued in the operation of these various businesses, in the formation of companies, in the flotation of their stocks, and in your business, in the stock exchange and elsewhere, up until the time of the beginning of the war?" Mr. Baruch replies, "I was gradually getting myself away from business, because I had made up my mind to retire, and I had been getting less active with that end in view, and I was not very much in sympathy with the organization of companies. I am not criticizing other men who engage in business that resulted in profits even before we had gotten into war. I had made my mind up to leave and do some other things that I hope to be able to do now, but that process was interrupted by my appointment as a member of the advisory commission without any suggestion or without any knowledge or idea it was coming." Does he mean that the process of getting out of business was interrupted by his appointment on the advisory commission, which appointment led straight to his complete rulership of the United States at war? Here's another exchange. Mr. Jeffries says, "Had any of the members of the advisory commission been engaged in the production of raw materials or in manufactured products, or not?" Mr. Baruch says, "I had." Jeffries replies, "In what way?" Baruch says, "I had made a rather deep study of the production and the distribution and manufacture of many of these raw materials. I had to make an intensive study of these things in order to do the things I was engaged in." Mr. Jeffries responds, "You were not running any raw material production?" Baruch replies, "I was interested in concerns. I was interested in the study and production of a great many of these things, because I developed and organized concerns which did it." Does he mean that he was interested in concerns at the time of his appointment? This would be an interesting point to clear up. Another matter that would be not only of interest, but of great usefulness in explaining the gathering of a Jewish government around the president during the war, is the question of Bernard M. Baruch's acquaintance with Woodrow Wilson. When did it begin? What circumstances or what person brought them together? There are stories, of course, and one of them may be true, but the story ought not be told unless accompanied by the fullest confirmation. Why should it occur that a Jew should be the one man ready and selected for a position of greatest power during the war? Mr. Baruch, in his testimony, sheds no light on this question. He had opportunity to do so, had he wished. Here's another exchange. Mr. Graham says, "I assume that you were personally acquainted with the president prior to the outbreak of the war?" Baruch says, "Yes, sir." Mr. Graham continues, "Up to the time that you were appointed as a member of the advisory commission, had you ever had any personal conferences with the president about these matters?" Baruch responds, "Yes, sir." Mr. Graham goes on, "Had he called you in consultation, or had he talked to you about these matters and about the matter of your appointment before you were appointed?" Mr. Baruch responds, "Never suggested anything about the appointment, because I would have told him that I would prefer not to be appointed." Mr. Graham asks, "Do you now recall, Mr. Baruch, how long before you were actually appointed as a member of that advisory commission you had your last conference with the president?" Baruch responds, "No." That's not all of Mr. Baruch's answer, but it is his reply to the question. Having said no, Mr. Baruch became very communicative on another matter. His complete reply is this: "No, but I can tell you something that may be of interest, and that is probably what you want to know. I had been very much disturbed by the unprepared condition of this country, so much so that I was one of the first men to support General Wood in the Plattsburgh encampment, and I think he will admit I gave him the first money and told him whatever he did I would guarantee to stand behind that movement, which happily only took a few $1,000s so far as I was concerned, having caught the public approval, and it went ahead, and in that relation, naturally, one had to think about the mobilization of the industries of the country, because people do not fight alone with their hands. They've got to fight with things. It's thus shown that Mr. Baruch was a four-handed gentleman. It was only the year 1915. The European War had then not become more than an amazing spectacle to the mass of the American people. But still, Mr. Baruch was convinced we were going to have war, and he spent his money on his guests. The government, which was then keeping us out of the war, quote-unquote, was also consulting with Mr. Baruch, who was already ahead of the government in creating the atmosphere of war in this country. If the reader, by a mental effort, can reconstruct the year of 1915 and then put into his picture of that year the element of which he was not then possessed, namely the activity of Mr. Bernard M. Baruch and other Jews, he will see that he did not know much about what was going on, even if he did read the newspapers with attention. To proceed with the examination, following the place where Mr. Baruch made his interesting disclosure on his part in the Plattsburgh experiment, we have another exchange. Mr. Graham asks, "That was about 1915, was it not?" Baruch replies, "Yes, 1915, and I had been thinking about it very seriously, and I thought we would be drawn into the war. I went off on a long trip, and it was while on this trip that I felt there ought to be some mobilization of the industries, and I was thinking about the scheme that practically was put into effect and was working when I was chairman of the board. When I came back from that trip, I asked for an interview with the president. It was the first time I had seen the president since his election, so far as I can remember now." Mr. Graham responds, "You mean his first election?" Baruch replies, "His first election, yes." So it is probable that Mr. Baruch, if any stress may be placed on the manner of his words, had known the president before. Ordinary men who meet the president seldom usually have a very clear recollection of these things. The fact probably is that Mr. Baruch saw the president so frequently that he found it difficult to distinguish the meetings in his memory. He describes the visit referred to here. "I explained to him as earnestly as I could that I was very deeply concerned about the necessity of the mobilization of the industries of the country. The president listened very attentively and graciously, as he always does. And the next thing I heard, some months afterward, my attention was brought to this Council of National Defense. Secretary Baker brought it to my attention. This was the first time I had met the Secretary of War. He asked me what I thought of it." Mr. Graham asks him, "That was before the bill was passed, before it became a law?" Baruch replies, "I think it was. I am not certain about that. I said I would like to have something different." This is rather important. A council is a council. Mr. Baruch wanted something different. Eventually, he did get something different. He got the president so to change matters as to make Mr. Baruch the most powerful man in the war. The Council of National Defense eventually became the merest sideshow. It was not a council of Americans that ran the war. It was an autocracy headed by a Jew, with Jews at every strategic point down the line. What Mr. Baruch did was very masterly, but it was not in the American manner. He did what he set out to do, but it is seriously to be questioned whether any man ought to have done what he did, and probably no one but a member of his race would have wanted to do it. Here we have another exchange. Mr. Graham asks, "Did the president express any opinion about the advisability of adopting the scheme you had proposed?" Mr. Baruch says, "I think I did most of the talking. I don't remember what the president said on that subject, but I think it can be best seen as expressed in the bill." Mr. Graham replies, "Did you impress him with your belief that we were going to get into the war?" Baruch says, I probably did. I would like to tell you exactly, but I do not want to guess at it." Mr. Graham responds, "That was your opinion at the time?" Mr. Baruch, "Yes, I thought we were going to get into the war. I thought a war was coming long before it did." The examination then reverted to Mr. Baruch's conference with the Secretary of War, in which the former had said he would like to have something different, quote-unquote. Mr. Graham says, "Mr. Baker said he thought it was the best that he could have gotten at the time?" Baruch responds, "I got that impression. Whether he said so or not, I don't know, but I got that impression that that was the best that could be gotten at that time." If the event had not turned out exactly as Mr. Baruch planned it, a great deal of his testimony might be discounted on the principle of the natural boastfulness of the Jew after a scheme has succeeded, but there is no discounting anything that he says. The president did exactly what Baruch wanted in a thousand matters, and what Baruch apparently wanted most of all was a ruling hand upon productive America, and that he got. He got it in a larger measure than even Lenin ever got in Russia. For here in the United States, the people saw nothing but the patriotic element. They did not see the Jewish government looming above them, yet it was there. The Council of National Defense, as originally constituted, the best that could be gotten at that time, though Mr. Baruch would like something different, was headed by six secretaries of the cabinet, the Secretaries of War, the Navy, the Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, and Labor. Beneath this official group was an advisory commission of seven men, three of whom were Jews. One of these Jews was Mr. Baruch. Beneath this advisory commission were scores and hundreds of men and many committees. One of the groups subordinate to the two groups just mentioned was the War Industries Board, of which Mr. Baruch was originally merely a member, Daniel Willard being the chairman of that group. Now, it was this War Industries Board which became the whole thing, as mentioned above, later on, and it was Mr. Baruch who became the whole thing in that board. The place where he was put became the cornerstone. He became the chief pillar of the war administration. The records show it. He himself admits it. What influence reached into this council of hundreds of Americans and chose a single Jew to be their undoubted lord and master for the duration of the war? Was it Baruch's brains that elevated him, or was it the suggestion of Jewish finance already well forward in its work of mobilization? There is no desire here to minimize the Baruch brain. Brains and money are the Jews' two greatest weapons. No Jew is picked for a key place who has not brains. Baruch has the brains. He is a ceaseless wonder among men who know him. He can do six things at once and control the most colossal operations without fuss or fever. He has both brains and money. But there is something for Jewry to learn. Brains and money are not enough. There is another element that even brains cannot cope with, and which renders money cheap. The chess-playing expert may mystify and compel admiration, but the chess player does not rule the world. So, Baruch did things. But Trotsky also has done things. The point is this: are people to be carried away by an appeal deliberately made to their imagination, or are they to scrutinize what has been done and weigh its consequences? The Jews could do greater things in the United States than even Baruch has done, if the opportunity offered, acts of superb ease and mastery, but what would it signify? The ideal of a dictator of the United States has never been absent from the group in which Baruch is found. Witness the work, Philip Drew, administrator, commonly attributed to Colonel Edward Mandel House, and never denied by him. As a matter of fact, Baruch could probably do a better job than Trotsky did. Certainly the recent experience which he had in governing the country during the war was a very valuable education in the art of autocracy. Not that it is by any means Mr. Baruch's possession alone, it is also the possession of scores of Jewish leaders who flitted about from department to department, from field to field, receiving a postgraduate course in the art of autocracy, not to mention other things. But before Mr. Bernard M. Baruch got through, he was the head and center of a system of control such as the United States government itself never possessed and never will possess until it changes its character as a free government. Here we have another exchange. Mr. Jeffries says, "In other words, you determined what everybody could have." Mr. Baruch replies, "Exactly. There's no question about that. I assumed that responsibility, sir, and that final determination rested with me." Mr. Jeffries says, "What?" Mr. Baruch goes on, "That final determination, as the president said, rested with me. The determination of whether the Army or the Navy should have it rested with me. The determination of whether the Railroad Administration could have it, or the Allies, or whether General Allenby should have locomotives, or whether they should be used in Russia or used in France." Mr. Jeffries interrupts, "You had considerable power?" Mr. Baruch responds, "Indeed I did, sir." Mr. Jeffries asks him, "And all those different lines, really, ultimately, centered in you so far as power was concerned?" Mr. Baruch says, "Yes, sir, it did. I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless, that is true." What preceded Mr. Baruch's attainment of this power, how far his power reached, and how it was used will be our next inquiry. This was published November 27th, 1920, of course, in the Dearborn Independent. There you go, folks. Did you know that a Jew, this powerful international financier Jew, Bernard M. Baruch, was essentially in charge and control of all of American industrial production during the Great War, the War to End All Wars, World War I? I bet you probably just thought that Trotsky or Lenin was in charge of goyim labor in Russia. Well, as it turns out, Bernard M. Baruch was in control of the industry of the nation. Imagine that. He decided who was going to get what for war materials and raw materials and production. Incredible stuff. You can't make this up. I hope you guys have enjoyed. I will spare you a rant. And until next time, guys, take care. God bless. Bye-bye.
Radio Ariane.